Funding for Think comes from SMU Master of Liberal Studies programs.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How do you get through the day when you cannot stop worrying? No life is spared the experience of anxiety over our own problems or those that affect people we love. If we're lucky enough to be mentally healthy, that awful gnawing dread recedes when the threat has passed. But for the estimated 40 million American adults who suffer from anxiety in any given year, the sensation of existential dread is a frequent or even constant companion, even in times when it would seem we have nothing real to worry about. My guest has lived with panic attacks, phobias, and uncontrollable worry since he was a small child. As editor of The Atlantic magazine, Scott Stossel's challenges have not kept him from achieving enviable professional success. But until he finally decided to come out about his lifelong anxiety, for years his suffering was compounded by the stress of trying to conceal it from friends and colleagues. Scott Stossel's book, My Age of Anxiety, Fear, Hope, Dread, and the Search for Peace of Mind, is out now in paperback. Scott, welcome to Think.
Thank you so much for having me.
Over and over reading this book, I was struck by one thought. Anxiety is exhausting.
That is a fair characterization. And it's also narcissistic, and the amount of sort of useless mental energy that's expended on worrying about things that you don't need to worry about, or worrying excessively about things that you don't need to worry about that much, or concocting elaborate ways, for many years I tried to hide the anxiety, and so going to elaborate lengths to hide my visits to psychotherapists and to keep my medications hidden, it can be quite tiring indeed. And I talk in the book and have written elsewhere about some episodes that. In retrospect, I can look at them through kind of a comic lens and see the humor in them. At the time, they were grueling and, as you say, exhausting. And I sort of come out the other end feeling rather wrung out, which is the experience I think that many people with clinical anxiety have every day.
You talk about humor. You describe yourself as Woody Allen trapped inside the body of John Calvin, which is, a funny characterization. It sounds like humor does not work as a coping mechanism when you are actively anxious.
No, when you're in the throes of it, very little works. And, I now have the sort of unusual or peculiar benefit of having spent 7 years researching this book, in addition to the benefit of, or mostly the benefit of 20 to 30 years of psychotherapy. So I have probably as much scientific understanding of the phenomenon of anxiety of any non sort of academic expert. And that does help to some degree because I'm able to sometimes head off panic attacks at the pass by recognizing them. I've become very familiar with what the symptomatology is. That knowledge can be helpful. And yet once a sort of phobic stimulus like being on an airplane that's going through turbulence, or being afraid I'm about to get sick, or being trying to ride a chairlift, all of that rationality goes out the door, and the kind of physiological and emotional power of the anxious response just overwhelms me, and I'm sort of helpless to overcome it. And in that case, yes, there's very little that I find humorous or amusing until sometimes after the fact.
And it is interesting. Anxiety is interesting because it does have those physiological symptoms that go along with the, excruciating mental state.
Exactly. I mean, the reality is that anxiety is basically a sort of distortion of an adaptive evolutionary response that is very helpful to keeping us as individuals and as a species alive, which is to say that the fear response or the fight or flight response is completely natural and adaptive. So in the state of nature, if you are being chased by a saber-toothed tiger or confronted by an enemy tribe, it makes sense for your body to have this kind of physiological response in which blood flows away from your gastrointestinal system to your strong muscles of your arms and legs, so you're prepared to fight the lion or run away from it. In that situation and in some others, it's adaptive. When it's not adaptive, and the problem for people who suffer from clinical anxiety or anxiety disorders is that that response gets triggered at inopportune times, and not just inopportune times, but just the wrong times. So there, you know, at moments when there's nothing actually to be afraid of, or where there may be something mildly to worry about, but the intensity of the anxious response is hugely disproportionate to what the actual threat is. And then you find yourself overwhelmed by this cascade of physiological sensations where you're sweating and you're dizzy and you feel nauseous and have other gastrointestinal symptoms and your head is swimming and you feel vertigo. And this then becomes accompanied by psychological, emotional symptoms of impending death and dread and just like the worst is about to happen and you sort of lose the ability to function optimally. And in that case, it can be quite debilitating and obviously is not a constructive adaptive mechanism.
You write about one of many panic attacks that you have had, and in this case you were at work and you had this like overwhelming compulsion to run outside. And what's so fascinating is that you write about the fact that you're telling yourself as this is happening and sort of building in scale to a crescendo, you're telling yourself this is just a panic attack. I've had a million before. It's always a panic attack. But in the back of your mind, something is saying, but maybe this is not a panic attack. This is the real heart attack, or this is the real physiological thing that is going to get me. It's this weird kind of dual awareness that what you're thinking isn't rational, and yet the absolute inability to overcome that with the emotional side of yourself.
Well, exactly. It's almost like in those moments, and again, I have the advantage here. I mean, I think many people, when they suffer their first panic attack, or people who aren't aware of the phenomenon, I mean, they are 100% convinced they're having a heart attack or dying because they're what else could be happening, that their body is going so haywire. For me, as in that account you described from my book, I sometimes end up, and it's almost like my amygdala, which is sort of the seat of the fear response, which is the sort of atavistic, primitive fight or flight response, is waging war against my frontal cortex, which is trying to tell me all these rational things like, look, the odds are that you're completely fine. These are the symptoms of a panic attack. And yet oftentimes – and sometimes I can use that rationality and breathing exercises to sort of calm myself down and convince myself, okay, you're fine. And I sort of headed off at the pass. Other times – the frontal cortex loses and the amygdala wins, and I end up convincing myself, you know, this may be a panic attack, but what if it's not? I may be actually having a heart attack or a stroke or coming down with some kind of terminal illness, and I just have this overwhelming impulse, and again, this is the fight or flight response, to get out as quickly as I can. And in that case, you know, I had this sort of embarrassing sequence where I, you know, bolted from my office, ran down the stairs, tried to get out the exit, and I was running so fast that the motion detector that was supposed to activate the door didn't work, and so I slam into the door. The exit sign falls off from above the door, clonks me on the head, and then lands on the ground with a big clatter, and the security guard ends up poking his head in from the lobby, and I sort of have to explain, you know, don't worry, I'm just trying to get outside.
How is anxiety officially diagnosed in a clinical sense? Like, how long do you have to experience those symptoms before a physician would say this is what your problem is?
It's not a straightforward bright red line between, mm-hmm. you know, what would be called sort of normal anxiety, or, you know, almost all of us experience stress that creates anxious symptoms and are quite normal. And even if they're not adaptive, they're not necessarily clinical. Where then is the line between normal adaptive or even maladaptive but still not clinical anxiety and an actual pathological anxiety disorder? And the official set of diagnoses comes from the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual, or the DSM, which is sort of the Bible of the American Psychiatric Association, which lays out, in very precise terms, kind of what are the symptoms that one must suffer in order to be diagnosed with, say, generalized anxiety disorder or panic disorder or social phobia or a specific phobia like fear of heights or airplanes. But the reality is that this is a document that, it's science, but it's kind of politics. And the distinctions can be kind of arbitrary. And I'm quoting this off the top of my head, so I might have the specifics wrong. But, for panic disorder, you have to have I think there's 13 symptoms, and you have to suffer from, four or seven of them over some period of time. And the period of time is, an arbitrary number of weeks. So why, X number of weeks as opposed to Y number of weeks, and why, X number of symptoms as opposed to Y symptoms. This is all sort of – this is where it gets politicized and the involvement of the insurance industry and the big pharmaceutical companies becomes pertinent because from their perspective, and this is mainly and I say this as somebody who has relied intermittently rather heavily on anti-anxiety medications and antidepressant medications and think generally speaking that all of the pharmaceutical companies are acting in good faith and with the interest of potential sufferers and patients in mind. Nevertheless, they have a profit-motivated interest in expanding the diagnostic categories so that they can have more people to prescribe this drug or that drug too. So it's not a clear-cut thing. And over the years, the definitions that we've used to both the sets of symptoms and the criteria that are used to define whether it's generalized anxiety disorder, which didn't exist before 1980, or panic disorder, which officially didn't exist before 1980, they change and evolve as the science advances, but also as the politics of the insurance companies and big pharma and different psychiatric subspecialties kind of battle with each other to find the right middle ground.
You started showing signs of anxiety as a small child. Can you talk about how the disorder manifested for you and how the symptoms finally got to the point that your parents thought, okay, we need to get some help?
Sure. Well, so I was officially diagnosed when I was 10, but before that point, and it's always a tricky thing because there are plenty of symptoms that kids can exhibit that are part of normal psychological development. So, for instance, separation anxiety in 2 or 3 and 4 and 5 year olds, we've all, if you have kids and you drop them off at preschool or kindergarten, you see the kids clinging to their parents and crying. That's not abnormal. That's a normal developmental stage. But sometimes separation anxiety, when it persists into 6, 7, 8 year olds, actually is evidence of an incipient anxiety disorder. And so for me, I had acute separation anxiety from a very young age. And I literally wore grooves in the carpet of my childhood bedroom because mm-hmm. I would pace around. If I was home with a babysitter and I was waiting for my parents to come home, And they were – not even if they were late, but if they were like 10 minutes from when they were supposed to be home, I would become absolutely convinced that they'd been killed in a car crash or had driven off. And so I would just be in utter paroxysms of misery, convinced that they'd died or abandoned me and I had been left alone on this earth. And then as I got to be about 7 or 8 years old, I developed the first of my – and at this point, most intense and longstanding of my phobias, which is to people who have it, they will instantly relate. And to those who don't, this will sound incredibly peculiar, but the pathological fear of vomiting, which is known as emetophobia. And so starting when I was about 6 or 7, I became a compulsive hand washer and would worry always about if kids were sick in my class. I had a nervous stomach and I would always worry that this was evidence that I was about to throw up. So I endured this for about 4 years before finally my parents, when I was about 10 years old, took me finally to a psychiatric hospital to get evaluated, where sure enough I was diagnosed with a collection of anxiety disorders. And at that point, they got me into see a therapist, which was enormously helpful. But what I've learned subsequently, both from my research and from dealing with the experience of my own kids, who unfortunately have been bequeathed my own anxiety, the earlier you can intervene, the better. And so, the 4 years between age 6 and age 10, if I could have gotten treatment at age 7, that actually might have been beneficial. My
guest is Scott Stossel. He's editor of The Atlantic and author of the book My Age of Anxiety, Fear, Hope, Dread, and the Search for Peace of Mind. The book is out now in paperback. We'll come back to the conversation in a couple of minutes. You can join it by calling 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or send me a tweet @ChrisBoydThink.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Master of Liberal Studies programs. Accepting applications for summer and fall to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree at SMU with concentrations in human rights, creative writing, and organizational dynamics. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with editor of The Atlantic, Scott Stossel. He's also author of a book called My Age of Anxiety, Fear, Hope, Dread, and the Search for Peace of Mind. The book is out now in paperback. If you want to be part of the conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372. Scott, you were saying that recent research has revealed that the earlier one starts treatment, the better control one can have over the symptoms over time. You actually discovered that there is quite a strong family history of this kind of problem within your biological family.
Indeed. I discovered this through research into my own family, but also this is proven out in reading the clinical or the academic literature on, you know, what they call kind of familial aggregation of disorder within families. And, you know, basically what that means is that if, you know, a couple of people in your family tree have an anxiety disorder, the likelihood of many other people in the family tree also having it becomes much greater. And what that meant in my own family's case, I actually went back and researched. So my great-grandfather, my mother's father's father, was a very successful professional academic. He was a professor of government at Harvard and actually was the dean of Harvard College back from the 19-teens until the 1940s, and had suffered from anxiety intermittently throughout his whole life. And in the 1940s, ended up breaking down and ended up – that was the beginning of him having sort of multiple hospitalizations in psychiatric hospitals and undergoing multiple rounds of electroshock treatment and sort of being in and out of the care of psychiatric hospitals for kind of the balance of his life. And then beyond that, you know, my own mother had a collection of phobias and anxieties that very much mirror my own. My sister has not been on a plane in 5 years and has other anxieties different from my own. I have, you know, first-degree cousins who suffer from anxiety. So there's plenty of evidence that what Freud called kind of the hereditary taint of mental illness, you know, runs thick through the bloodlines of my family. And it was both sort of consoling on the one hand to read about my great-grandfather, who I only knew — he died when I was 5 years old — but, you know, to feel the sort of kinship with him, and also fascinating to read. I actually, for the purposes of research on the book, procured his psychiatric records from McLean Hospital, where he was in the 40s and 50s, and to read about, you know, how different the treatment regimens were then and the drugs that they would use to try to treat him, but also a little bit terrifying because, you know, I worry, am I going to end up like him, relegated to repeated hospitalizations and to, you know, electroshock therapy. When I would express this concern to my psychotherapist, he would say, look, you only have 1/8 of his genes, for one thing, and two, that was 40 or 50 years ago. We've got a lot better medications then, so you're probably okay and you're a lot more resilient than maybe he was.
Has medical science been able to tease out the difference between the effect of genes and the effect of, say, being raised by a father or a mother who has severe anxiety and you know, a child sort of taking cues about the nature of the world from living with that parent?
Not completely, and I don't think they'll ever be able to definitively delineate what's purely genes and what's purely environment. It's clearly both. And my own sense, based on my personal experience and, again, on extensive reading in the academic literature, is that there really is an extremely strong genetic component to one's individual capacity to be either resilient to or susceptible to anxiety. And that, you know, comes from the constellation of genes. You know, a lot of people are trying to identify media will talk about, you know, oh, here's the Woody Allen gene or the single gene. I don't think they'll ever find a single gene that is the source of either susceptibility to or resistance to anxiety. But there are constellations that lead to kind of a temperament that is more highly reactive to stress. So I think if you think of a pyramid, at the base of it, there is this powerful genetic determining factor. And the there are now piles and piles of studies that have accumulated over the last decade or so, suggesting that there are genes that render some people almost completely immune to anxiety, and gene variants that render other people highly susceptible to that. That said, however, and this is something that I feel pretty strongly, genes are not completely determinative, and there are all kinds of things overlaid on top of that that include, as Freud would have told us 100 years ago, your early childhood experiences, whether you've been subjected to trauma, your life experience in general, luck, the level of stress in your life, and whether you're getting enough sleep and exercising and eating well. So it's one's experience of anxiety, it has kind of many, many contributing factors. Genes are an incredibly potent one, but it's not one that is necessarily going to doom you if you have anxious genes to a life of terminal anxiety. You can overcome it, and sort of the cutting edge term of art in psychiatry and psychology is resilience. And to some degree, there's a lot of evidence that resilience, which is to say the non-susceptibility to anxiety, anxious responses to stressful situations, is genetically conferred. But you can also learn resilience through exposing yourself to the things that you fear and learning that they're not necessarily going to kill you or that you can overcome them, and through other ways too. And even, for instance, the Pentagon is studying how can we make our soldiers more resilient so that they're more resistant to post-traumatic stress disorder, which is a subspecies of anxiety disorder.
You have, on numerous occasions, forced yourself to get up and speak in public, and I gather that this is a really, really difficult thing for you to do, or has been in the past.
Yes. I was there. There's the famous quote, and I forget where it comes from, that many of them, among the most common phobias, in addition to heights, claustrophobia, flying, is public speaking. And I think public speaking tends to rank as the highest. And when you actually look at the data, the number of people who say they would rather die than actually have to speak in public led someone to conclude that actually people would prefer to be the corpse at a funeral rather than the eulogist. And I would kind of put myself in that category. The irony is, having now published two books, and in particular this most recent book, which is ironically about anxiety, I've sort of been forced to endure protracted exposure therapy where I have to again and again go on television or radio shows or show up in public venues and talk to a bunch of people. And that is, as the most therapists will tell you, a way of reducing your anxiety. I've also, now having published a book about anxiety, it used to be before I did that, I was always trying so hard to hide the fact that I had these underlying anxieties. And my fear was, and this happened a couple of times where I would literally be presenting to a group of 40 people for my job, to advertise or what have you, and I would be overwhelmed by panic and literally couldn't speak or would feel I was about to pass out or get sick and I'd have to run off stage. Now, having preemptively outed myself as anxious, I always feel like I could just say, well, look, I'm sorry, refer to chapter 4, which is the chapter that talks about my fears of public speaking.
Hmm. Have you felt over the course of your life that your anxiety is a burden on the people around you? And I'm wondering about how it's affected your relationships.
I've tried to the best of my ability to limit the degree to which it's a burden on other people, and I've been more successful at that professionally. When I published the book in hardcover a year ago, almost to a person, my colleagues were stunned and said, "I had no idea you were going through this." I'm so, they were very sympathetic, but I clearly successfully managed to hide the anxiety and thereby to withhold from them the burden of having to, deal with it.
Yeah.
My immediate family is a different story. Going back to when I was a kid, this was, quite an issue for my parents throughout all of my childhood when they were trying to figure out what to do with this, anxious, terrified kid. And then my wife, who we first got together in the late 1990s, and at least, she knew what she was getting into early when I had planned this sort of what was meant to be a romantic vacation to London. But of course, I have this acute flying phobia. And I had told her about my anxieties by this point, but they were sort of an abstract concept to her until we got on the plane and I had this sort of complete anxious panic attack, meltdown. And to my great relief, she didn't abandon me at that point. But it is a huge burden on her because she's the one, I think, who more than anyone, you know, to the extent that I hide my anxiety, I hide it from everyone except from her. And she's the one who has to deal with, you know, the meltdowns and the quasi breakdowns and, you know, the existential dread and kind of morbid thoughts.
We're going to take some calls here in just a minute. But before that, is there an ideal way for people who encounter you, who, you know you, to help you cope or to treat you when you are in the throes of a panic attack or a really bad day with regard to your anxiety?
Good question. I mean, I've been so good at managing for the most part to hide my anxiety, which is to say that, you know, if I was undergoing a mild enough version that I was able to kind of stay wherever I was and just hide it, people didn't necessarily know I was going through it. And if it overwhelmed me, I would sort of run away and hide in the garage or whatever. And so nobody was ever presented with having to do that. Speaking generally, I mean, it's funny. I mean, it's hard to what you don't want to say to someone who's in the throes of anxiety attack is, "Oh, just relax, you'll be fine." You know, if you could just relax, you would.
Right.
The main thing is to just be sort of present and sympathetic and you know, non-judgmental. And that will help people get through an attack. And if you're, you know, going through one, and again, this is much easier said than done, and I say this both based on research and personal experience, you know, simple things like doing deep diaphragmatic breathing, you know, breathing through your stomach slowly, and trying to, you know, stay present in the moment and focus on what's around you. The you know, look at the sky, look at the physical, you know, kind of attributes of the world around you can distract you from the anxiety, and that can work. It, as I say, it's easier said than done, but that's a good you know, quick and dirty rule of thumb is deep breathing and stay in the moment and just let the anxiety wash over you. Don't try to fight it.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's speak with Michael in Dallas. Hi, Michael.
Hello. I'm so glad you have a guest on talking about this. Real quickly, I off and on have suffered from anxiety as well, and I had a question and then a quick comment, and that is, I sort of came to my own realization that part of mine was due to just years and years and years of being immersed in a very highly anxious family unit where just the whole family was just a bundle of anxiety, you know, amongst themselves and all that, where I was going to ask your guest, has there been any research done to see whether or not anxiety can actually accumulate sort of like a toxin in your actual cellular, at a cellular level? Because one of the ways that I was able to find out some things about my anxiety was dealing with a kinesiologist who really, really helped me get back to the body feelings, the actual, you know, physical feelings of being in that anxiety. And it has been incredibly helpful to where I just I'm not even bothered by it anymore. And I don't know whether that's the reason or not, but that was my question and comment. I'll hang up and listen.
Thanks for your call.
The short answer is absolutely yes. I mean, as we were discussing earlier, there is a kind of double whammy factor. If you're in a family that suffers, that has a number of people with anxiety, you've got not only the genetic load that has been sort of disseminated to you by your forebears, which make you genetically anxious, but you've also got the kind of anxious environment, and you're sort of learning from the modeling of your family, you know, how to be anxious. And so it's sort of, you get a double whammy of your genes making you more anxious and then living in this kind of toxic anxious environment making you more anxious. And in terms of, you know, I don't really know about that. There's sort of mixed evidence about whether it gets embedded in at the cellular level, except there are these fascinating studies of people who have been subjected to trauma. And in particular, just to cite one example, descendants of Holocaust survivors actually have higher tend on average to have higher levels if you show them videos of stressful things, even having nothing to do with the Holocaust, which they have no personal experience of. Their grandparents or great grandparents went through this. But if you show them something like, you know, violence in the Sudan, they will have a greater physiological response on average to seeing that violence than a control group, which suggests that there is some way in which the experience of, you know, being subjected to extreme anxiety and trauma gets plastered into your tissues and into your cells in some way, as the caller was saying, that gets transmitted not only to you but to your kids and even your grandkids. And this has actually been shown in monkey populations as well.
People, you know, there's the expression sometimes uttered seriously and sometimes uttered as a sort of joke. People will say, I need a Xanax, which would make us feel like maybe popping a pill, you know, you wait 15 minutes and everything goes away. It's clearly not been that simple in your experience or in the experience of many people who have really clinical levels of anxiety.
Yeah, I mean, I have complex views about medication, as I alluded to earlier. On the one hand, I actually think for me, and I talk in the book about my long history of the litany of drugs that I've taken that have worked and not worked in varying degrees, and have worked for a while and then stopped working or have worked but produced horrible side effects. That, I mean, speaking of Xanax in particular and the class of drugs that it's a part of, benzodiazepines, this is controversial, but, you know, for me personally, that has been the drug of last resort. You know, more than anything else, Xanax, Klonopin, Ativan, all in the benzodiazepine category, if I take enough of it, tend to be able to overpower my anxiety and make me less miserable. And I thank God for that. But A, there are people for whom benzodiazepines don't work at all. B, there are certain side effects associated with benzodiazepines in terms of you know, sedation and cognitive impairment that are bad. We don't really know what the long-term effects on the brain are of this. There's some evidence that it leads to an increase in Alzheimer's disease or dementia in old age. And it also can lead in some people to dependency and addiction, meaning, you know, in the most minor case, that you need to take more and more of the same drug to achieve the same effect. And in the worst case, that you actually become physically dependent and can't give up on it without having to, you know, have seizures or horrible side effects. So, I do think that benzodiazepines can be a magic drug, but drugs are not the first line of defense. And if you can, you know, my view is if you can manage your anxiety without drugs, you're better off. If you can't, drugs are okay.
Scott Stossel is with us. We're talking about his book, My Age of Anxiety: Fear, Hope, Dread, and the Search for Peace of Mind. We'll return in 2 minutes.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Master of Liberal Studies programs. Accepting applications for summer and fall to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree at SMU with concentrations in human rights, creative writing, and organizational dynamics. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is editor of the Atlantic magazine, Scott Stossel. His book is called My Age of Anxiety: Fear, Hope, Dread, and the Search for Peace of Mind. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372. That's where we find Melissa in Dallas. Hi, Melissa.
Hi. I have a question that you started to answer earlier on. There was a New York Times article that recently suggested a fairly high correlation between taking benzodiazepines and dementia. So now, of course, I have enormous anxiety about taking a drug that has proved to be very helpful to me in the past. And I'm wondering what the literature says about just how strong a correlation there is.
Thanks for your call.
I worry about that as well, Melissa, as someone who's resorted rather heavily at times to benzodiazepines myself. It's not and I'm not a scientist, so I take this, you know, qualify this accordingly. But I have talked to other scientists, and there was recently an editorial in a major scientific journal, and I'm forgetting which one it was. I think it might have been Science, but I could be wrong about that, actually saying that for that reason, among others, benzodiazepines should be classified as a regulated substance by the FDA in the way that, LSD and other drugs are. There is significant pushback, and I can tell you this from talking to researchers in the field who are have treated anxious patients for years and years using benzodiazepines with great success, who have not seen this. So again, I have ambivalent views on this. I think the jury is still out, and I think there is some cause for concern. But if you've been taking it benzodiazepines for a while without any problem, we have enough other stuff to worry about. Don't worry about it yet because the jury is still out. And I say that, again, not as a firsthand researcher myself. This is based on what I've read and the psychiatrists I've talked to at leading universities.
Do you feel like all the years that at work you tried to conceal your anxiety functioned for you somehow as a kind of coping mechanism? Like if you had to keep it secret, it could only get so bad during the times that you were with your colleagues, that sort of thing?
Yes and no. I mean, there were times when the sheer effort of having to hide my anxiety kind of exacerbated my anxiety and would lead me to, run off and hide and would make me more unhappy and just, in my book, I talk about my therapist, Dr. W, who talks about what he calls impression management. And that is, trying to convince everyone that the outward veneer of confidence and competence that you project is the real you, and trying at all costs, to prevent the house of cards from come crumbling down so that they don't see the internal vulnerability and anxiety within. And that is both a symptom of, and he would argue, a contributor to anxiety. So in that sense, it was a bad thing. On the other hand, being anxious, there are a lot of ways in which either anxiety itself or kind of characterological traits associated with anxiety are beneficial and adaptive in the workplace. Being anxious can make you a perfectionist. It can make you conscientious. It makes you worry about what other people think of you. And all of these things maybe make you a better worker and a better employee and a better colleague. And I think some of those factors were in effect for me and actually helped me over the years. And I think just one other anecdote, I talked to a therapist who talks about how a lot of his most miserable patients are anxious lawyers. Hmm. And they make themselves miserable worrying about things. But if you are a client in search of a lawyer, you want to hire one of these guys because they are exceptionally good at worrying about every worst case scenario that could befall you and preparing for it. An effect of their anxiety is to make them very, very effective at preparing, legal defenses for people. So anxiety is not without its benefits in the work world.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's speak now with Liz in Dallas. Hello, Liz.
Yes. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I had recently been reading a book on obsessive compulsive disorder, and it seems to me that obsessive thoughts could be either anxiety caused or anxiety resulting in anxiety. And I wondered if you have any research that relates anxiety to OCD, because it seems that the OCD people want to call it just OCD, and I seem in my life to find it related very much to anxiety.
Thanks.
Do you have any thoughts?
Thanks.
Thank you.
That's a really interesting question and a very timely one, because for 30 some years, OCD was actually categorized by the American Psychiatric Association as a subcategory of anxiety disorders. OCD was an anxiety disorder because for many patients with OCD, their obsessions and their compulsions are really tightly associated with great anxiety. In the last edition, the most recent edition of the DSM, which I think is the DSM-5, which came out a year ago in May, they actually removed OCD from the anxiety disorders and put it in a separate category with impulsive disorders like Tourette's syndrome. And a lot of therapists I've talked to think that's wrong, because they explain that for every OCD patient they treat, the obsessions and compulsions are always associated with anxiety. And in particular, you know, with many OCD patients, they have these obsessions, and then the way they deal with their obsessions is by exercising certain compulsions, you know, compulsive behavior, thoughts, behaviors, you know, checking. And if they can't exercise those compulsions, they become extremely overwhelmingly anxious, and the only thing that relieves their anxiety is to exercise the compulsion. So there is a very, very tight link in my view and many experts' views between anxiety and OCD, and I talk a lot about that in my book. And the short version is that, yes, OCD is tied. You know, whether it's technically classified as an anxiety disorder or not, there is a high quotient of anxiety associated with it.
Let's go back to the phones now. We have Anne on the line in Fort Worth. Hello, Anne.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
My question for you all is, Scott, you briefly touched on, you mentioned that you had a fear of vomiting as a child, and I have never heard anybody else say this before, because this is also something that I have had over the years. It's obviously lessened. However, I do have anxiety, and I was just shocked when you said that. Do you mind elaborating a little bit on, because I've Googled, et cetera, but do you mind elaborating a bit on that subject for me?
Not at all. And in fact, your response is one of the most common responses I get. I have heard from tens or scores, if not hundreds of people saying exactly what you said, which is they heard me talking on a radio show, or they read the book or came across something I'd written and said, boy, I didn't know this was a thing. I thought that I was the only person suffering from this. And actually, the dawn of the internet age, I don't think many psychiatrists and psychologists realized how common this was. But now, because they can go to – there's emetophobia support groups and things like this, and they can actually begin to research, it may be that emetophobia is as common as the fifth most common – specific phobia.
Wow.
It affects more women than men. I'm an outlier here. And it can be completely debilitating. There was an article in a UK publication recently where a British psychotherapist was talking about how many of his patients who suffer from acute emetophobia say they would rather die than vomit. And that sounds crazy to anyone who doesn't have it, to emetophobia. To those who do, you say that's it. And it's a bit of a mystery, you know, where this comes from. My mother had the same phobia, and I'd always sort of assumed that I'd learned it from her. But then fascinatingly, I, you know, was at great pains. I have two kids. My daughter is now 11 and my son is 8. And I was at great pains to hide this phobia from them, because I always assumed I learned my emetophobia from my mother, who had this. But then my daughter actually developed the same phobia at the same age, 6 or 7, that I did, which makes you wonder, is there, you know, did I secretly reveal some anxiety about this, or is it genetic? And there are actually evolutionary explanations why this phobia might exist. You know, the fear of other people vomiting might cause you to run away from toxins in the state of nature. But it's really not fully understood at this point. And but there are a number of therapists who specialize in treating this. There are things you can order online. So it's a very, very common phobia, and one that there are therapists who can help you deal with.
All right. And next on the phone, we have James in Dallas. Hi, James.
Hi. You've spoken a lot about specific phobias. Can you speak a little bit to the difference between that and say, generalized anxiety, which is sort of what I've dealt with? Not anxiety will come not from specific places, but just sort of seemingly out of nowhere, and it will sort of rise and fall. And so it's, in a way, is it sort of harder to identify and treat, or what do you think?
Yeah, I mean, and generalized anxiety disorder is a little bit more controversial within the field, because it only came into existence in 1980. I talk in the book about how sort of the arbitrary way in which it was designated, or how it was, you know, it was basically a bunch of psychiatrists having a dinner and drinking a bunch of wine and trying to come up with categories they could add into the DSM-3. And they were talking about a colleague who was just sort of generally anxious. And they said, oh, well, there must be something called generalized anxiety disorder. So they invented that, wrote it into the DSM-3, and then conducted tons of studies to measure it. That said, it is. I know from the clinical literature, it's a real and extremely difficult thing to deal with. It's often comorbid, as the specialists say, which is to say, it's commonly co-occurring with depression. And the most common features are sort of a general level of worry, and that is kind of relentless, and you start to ruminate, and you have a very hard time making decisions about everything from should I take this job or should I not, to what kind of sandwich should I order at the deli, in a way that becomes really distracting and intrusive. And you know, the good news is that they've developed the research has found medications and forms of therapy, cognitive behavioral therapy being the form that's most effective for many of these kinds of anxiety disorder. A lot of people are suffering from the kind of GAD that you do, and there are also ways to treat that as well.
So, Scott, people who don't have anxiety disorder can probably think back on their lives and point to whatever number of occasions when, for some reason, they really felt a great deal of anxiety. I wonder if for you it's the opposite, if you can think of a handful of times when you experienced like a sort of sustained tranquility for a matter of days or weeks or however long it might be.
Good question. I mean, it definitely waxes and wanes over time. And I think this is true for everyone. I mean, there are very few people who, you know, with a sufficient amount of stress, almost everyone will, you know, break down with at some point with symptoms of anxiety or, you know, post-traumatic stress disorder. And the exceptions to that are, you know, the very rare people who are extremely resilient and people who are, you know, sociopaths or psychopaths. Yeah. For me, it's true. Like, you know, for whatever reason, college, my junior year of college, you know, I was heavily medicated intermittently throughout junior high and high school. And then I got to college and things were just better. And I, you know, have a whole host of theories for why that might have been. And then I got out of college and things were worse again. So, yes, I mean, it kind of comes and goes. Sometimes you can understand why that is. I mean, and it's obvious, it's if you have fewer stressors and things are going well in your life, there's less reason to be anxious. And if things are stressful and you're having a hard time and, you know, worrying about things, as many of us do in the current state of the economy, there are more reasons to be naturally anxious. But it does kind of wax and wane. But sometimes it's inexplicable. And you'll have a period of remission, which may be, you know, I there was a period when I first went on Paxil, which is an SSRI antidepressant, in the late 90s. I had about 9 months of being as tranquil and serene as I'd ever been. And then suddenly that ended and I was anxious again. So, you know, who knows what accounts for that?
It seems to me to be a good thing that more and more people are being unashamed of their mental illness and the things that they've done to take care of themselves, particularly people who are successful, right? Because it shows that it's possible to be okay and still be coping with a chronic illness. But I wonder if there have been downsides to you of coming out in this way and putting your life out there for everyone to read.
Well, one sort of, you know, meta irony of the thing is that, you know, one of the things I always feared most was to have my anxiety detected by other people. Hmm. And of course, on the one hand, as I said earlier, you know, I sort of have now preemptively admitted my anxiety. So, well, if they discover it, you know, I've already admitted it. On the other hand, I always worry, are people now scrutinizing me for signs of anxiety? And, you know, you do worry about, are people thinking less of you? Are they, you know, their society, the amount of stigma associated with anxiety and mental illness generally has declined, but it still does exist. And, you know, one wonders in what ways am I compromising myself professionally or personally by having revealed that. But I hope that on balance, you know, what I've contributed to reducing stigma more generally and to mitigating my own shame has been, on balance, a positive thing.
Scott Stossel's book is called My Age of Anxiety: Fear, Hope, Dread, and the Search for Peace of Mind. Scott, it's been really nice talking with you. Thank you so much for making this time for us.
Oh, well, thanks so much for having me on. I really appreciate it.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is associate producer with help on the phones today from Celine Alba. Our executive producer is Jeff Whittington. You can contact the show via email at think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.